Well, we know those ancient days. We know what the earlier researchers in medicine, physiology and anatomy, for example, went through in order somehow to keep alive the spark of knowledge in this somewhat vulgar, somewhat discredited area of science, and even over in the humanities, the literary and dramatic arts, the graphic and plastic arts, as we know. There was a long, dark period where nobody did anything very original, let's say between the fall of the Roman Empire and the building of the great cathedrals. Nobody did anything very original in writing or in thinking or in forms of art or in agriculture, in transportation, in science, in economics. And worse than that, hardly anybody bothered to find out what had been known centuries before. So the universities, going back all through this period, going back 700 or 800 years, have learned that one lesson, that you must keep the laboratories fresh. You must bring fresh minds freshly to the problems. You must have freedom. So if we emphasize the laboratories, if we're rather soft toward microscopes and ill-smelling chemicals and strange research animals, some of which escape from the laboratories occasionally, if we study things that are very large and some things so small we hardly know whether or not they exist, at least as living organisms, don't pass that by as something not much too related to your problem of adding so many hundred pounds of meat for so many hundred pounds of corn feeding. I think all of you here sense the intricate, permanent, and creative relationship between those two sets of events. Well, those of you who have been students here, and you all have been, because you're all students right now in the best sense of the word, those of you who have been here as undergraduate or graduate students, who send your children here, know that it isn't enough to have the knowledge I'm speaking of contained only in the laboratories, only in the rather esoteric writings of the scholars and researchers speaking one to another. You know that in order for it to be alive, in order for us to discover new talent, and to keep this chain of events alive and strong, we must have the young brought into a scholarly relationship to what's been going on in the world and what may go on in the future. That's what we call education. That's what we call instruction or curriculum, examinations, promotions. Those are just the machinery of it all. And we think so much of it in this country that we insist upon it for every child by the age of 6 or so, and we insist upon it for a rather substantial period of time. Then for those who have the promise and the interest and the drive, who see ahead of them, we set up these advanced opportunities in colleges and universities, and we do our best to give this lamp of learning to them, and to ask them to think, to do, to learn, to reason, to put things together. We're rather proud of our record here in education, in the field of agriculture generally. If I had the time, I could quote the statistics showing what our graduates are doing. They are leaders in the United States and over the world. They are leaders in some of the most abstract fields which underlie agriculture and which drive it to further accomplishment. Well, I should say then that the two great legs of our three-legged plan here are research and instruction. But there is a third leg, and without it, I don't think we would be in a very stable equilibrium. And the third is what we call public service. Now, you people here today, as I see it, partake of all the advantages of the university, but in varying degrees. If you're here with your brothers or sisters or your children who are majoring in some branch of agriculture or some science basic to agriculture, then so far as those young people are concerned, at this moment of their lives, instruction is probably the main thing. If they're advanced students, they're beginning to enter into research. But in your lives, more generally, your immediate interest is in this third leg, in this third branch of the university's work, in public service. Now, I don't have to tell you that many colleges and universities pay little attention to this factor and almost no attention to it in the field of agriculture. They aren't expected to. In times of emergency, however, the most pure of the liberal arts colleges in New England, let us say, discover there is some immediate practical military defense relationship between what they teach and what they learn and what they can do for their country. But if you press them, they think the very best thing they can do is to turn out intelligent, well-educated graduates. They feel quite happy if they have achieved that. I guess any university feels happy if it has achieved that much. But in our land-grant colleges and our state universities, that is not enough. We believe that knowledge does not get corrupted by being used. We believe it's extended and deepened by making the attempt to show the meanings and the applications to everybody, to every citizen who may be interested in the results. And we believe in getting away from the campus through our extension and other experts. And we believe in bringing people to the campus, sometimes for only a few hours, sometimes for a few days or a few weeks, or a special summer institute. We have no sense of conflict at all in doing all these things. Now, let me review rapidly what we should have in the university if we didn't bother about practical technology, about extension work at all. We would still have everything that the New England type college has. We would have a fine library, good instructors, good laboratories. We'd encourage young people, we would train them, we'd prepare them for work. We'd have some kind of relationship with them as alumni, if only to collect a few dollars from them annually and send them some kind of a publication. But we wouldn't feel that we had to track them down to their homes or their jobs, you see, to find out if what they had learned was being helpful, to find out if their family or their community or their social or educational or economic organizations needed help. No, we wouldn't do that. We'd still be a college, we would still be a university, and perhaps a very distinguished one. But we would stop there. Now, that has never been the ultimate aim of the land-grant idea. It's always been these three things which I have mentioned. As a matter of fact, if you're historically minded, you get the feeling that the abstract and scholarly and research aspects of the work more or less derived from the necessity of rendering practical aids to persons and to communities. But we don't care much about that now because, as I have said, the argument is circular. You can't render the aid in the long run unless you extend knowledge. Here are other things that we do in a general way, and I want to close this part of my talk and get down to some of the agricultural issues as I see them. We have been helpful, I think, in improving education at all levels. The universities, the state colleges, state teachers' colleges, after all, have a stake in your community, and you have a stake in all these colleges, including the university, because you know as well as I do that one of the things you depend upon for good educational instruction and supervision and leadership in your own school system, whether it's a little one or two room school or a consolidated school or a county high school, one of the things you must have is a well-trained staff. Otherwise, the buildings and the roads never seem to make sense. They only make sense if somebody comes into your community well-trained and with a feeling of mission on behalf of your young children from 5 or 6 years upward. And those persons, as you know, come largely from our colleges and universities, and particularly from those that are public and are especially interested in training of teachers. But that isn't all. There's a relationship between the university and the amount of money that you get for teaching through state aid, through taxation. It takes a state a long time to realize, I'm afraid it takes it a long time, to realize that the people pay the money in and it goes to Springfield but doesn't or shouldn't thereby become the monopoly of people who live or work in Springfield. The idea that much of this money should come back in a direct fashion in aid to the work, the business, the education, the health, protection, and understanding of citizens at the local level has now been well sustained by all the scholars who have looked into it, but there is a lag. Therefore, at universities and colleges where we study these things, we try to show that after all, you can't generalize people. If you generalize them to the extent of getting them out of their community lives, then you have lost something. Whether you're talking about a good schoolroom, a good farm, a good road, a good family life, a good community activity, a recreation, or church work, it doesn't mean anything if you look so far away from where you are that these values and these benefits are always given to you from some external source and to some external group. I think we have had whole political movements in this country, and you could name them as well as I, that get so far removed from where we live and where our hopes and ambitions are that they tend to fall flat. They tend to become unreal. And so it is that a great part of the work of any university, as I see it, must have its observable and measurable effects in the citizens, in the quality of their reading, in the kinds of teachers they get, the kinds of professional people, doctors, lawyers, pharmacists, nurses, and all the rest of it. There must be this sharing of understanding and this mutual service. Similarly, economists who studied the question point out that as you raise the general level of education, and it's been raised enormously in this country, and particularly in the Middle West and Far West, you increase the people's wants. People who can't read don't like telephones. Why don't they? Well, they don't like to look in the telephone book. It's an obstruction to you if you can't read. You remember the chap who was in an institution which was thought to be best for his benefit and protection in view of his limited capacities. But he got bored and he heard that people sometimes went to plays, and so he thought he'd like to go to one, but the superintendent told him that was rather hard to do. They were far away and expensive, but he might at least read one. And the inmate said, "Fine, you give me a play and I'll read it and see what it is they're talking about." So the superintendent, rather stymied at having let the conversation get so far along, looked around desperately and picked up the telephone book and said, "Here's a recent play. Try that." He talked to him a couple of days later and said, "What'd you think of it?" Well, the inmate shook his head. He said, "There certainly were an awful lot of characters, but not very much action." Well, as we have moved in our studies into the Deep South, for example, we have discovered, researchers in the social studies particularly, that you don't sell many of the things you people are interested in. There isn't much of a market. People don't have very good schools. They don't have very good roads. They don't have much reading or communicating material. Radio or a refrigerator becomes a great luxury. The idea of electrification of their work and home facilities is still rather remote to many of them. Therefore, their needs are small, their income is small, and we get into this vicious economic circle. Low ambition, low level of aspiration, low ability to pay for anything, and obviously, very few things around that anybody will try to sell them. So I think that all of us have a stake in the quality of education, beginning at the lowest levels of literacy. And in those levels, there's so little demand that the person rarely produces anything but has to be provided for by the state, and moving right on up through. The more education, the more proper education, consistently with one's abilities and ambitions, not just poured onto him, the better he will become, the more resourceful, more meaningful in his purchases. He will want more insurance. He'll be more interested in clothing, in shelter, in electric power, in travel, in books, in recreation, in communication. It's hard to interest a person who can't read or won't read in many of the things that are closest to your ambitions, whether you're thinking of yourselves as producers or simply as neighbors and citizens.